Hello there, friends. It's the Lookout Landing Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Weber. Today's guest is Mike Curto. Mike is the Tacoma Rainiers broadcaster. We recently met at the Mariners Media Luncheon. I've been trying to have him on the podcast for a while, and we finally worked out a time where we can get it done. So here it is. Mike's here to give a little bit of perspective on the minors and maybe some cool stories, and you know how we usually do these things. So let's not waste any more time. Let's get into it. Here's the podcast, Mike Curto. Thanks for listening.
Mike.
Scott, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Excellent.
So what's going on this offseason? Where are you staying around the area, all that stuff?
Oh, yeah. I live in Tacoma year-round.
Perfect.
I've lived here since the Rainiers hired me.
Living in Tacoma, down by the water or right in the heart of it?
I live kind of near Point Defiance Park. So
there you go. That's a nice area down there. I feel like people don't realize that there's a lot of awesome parts to Tacoma.
Oh, Tacoma's totally underrated as a city, and it took me a while to get used to that because I moved here from I'd been working for a team in the California League, Rancho Cucamonga, which is like an hour east of Los Angeles.
Yep.
And it's just, you know, it's sunny all the time. It's hot. You have L.A. right there and everything. And then I got hired here, and my first day was – I arrived on January 1st of 1999, and March 1st of that year or thereabouts, I get the newspaper, and it says, record 100 consecutive days of rain. That's the headline. So I first arrived here right in the middle of that, and that took some getting used to. And then, you know, so did the city of Tacoma, but I've come to really like it. Tacoma's kind of a city with – kind of hidden spots that it takes you a while to find, you know, and kind of find the spots you like in this town.
Sure, for sure. Now, are you a Cal guy? I know you're Berkeley. You went to Berkeley. Your love for the Golden Bears is well known. What about football, though? Are you on board with the Seahawks? Do you have some allegiance to something in California?
I'm gonna take the Fifth Amendment on that one.
We know.
Okay. Let's just leave it. I'll leave it to this. I watched the NFC Championship game at home by myself because that seemed to be the best option. But now that that's over and the Seahawks are in it, I'd like to see the Seahawks win the Super Bowl. It'd be great for the region, and you know, hopefully that'll happen. And they're a lot of fun to watch. You know, I watched most of their games this year because they're always on, and you know, they're a blast to watch. And I hope they beat the Broncos on Sunday.
All right. Well, okay. So you're not necessarily the begrudging San Francisco fan. You're a Niners fan, but you don't get wrapped up in the maybe all the hatred for the Seahawks.
Oh, no, I actually don't have any of the hatred at all. When I grew up a Niners fan as a kid, and you know, the Niners rival back then was the Rams.
Yeah.
And I guess kind of still are to some regard, and the Seahawks rivalry is rather newfound just in the last few years. And you know, I used to, you know, even before the Seahawks joined the NFC West, when they were in an AFC team, I used to go to their home games and stuff and have fun and root for them. So, you know, now they're in the same division, but you can't just all of a sudden like hate them. And then on top of that, as a Niners fan, I had no expectation at all that they could possibly win in Seattle in the NFC Championship game. It just seemed like such a long shot. And then the game turned out to be kind of a tease, as you know. But, you know, it was still a lot of fun. And, you know, I wish the Seahawks the best in the Super Bowl.
Legendary game. I've already watched it from start to finish. For me, one of the best playoff games in NFL history. Honestly, I think it's just going to go down as one of the all-time greats.
Yeah, it really was a fantastic football game.
How weird is it that LA still doesn't have a football team? Like sometimes I just think about that from a totally like you don't know anything about the NFL. Maybe you live in Europe or something like that, and you move to America, and everyone talks about LA and the NFL, and they don't have an NFL team. It's still totally, totally weird to me that this most popular league exists without a team there.
Yeah, that's actually incredible. You know, it kind of defies logic, and you know they've had multiple opportunities to, you know, retain a team in Los Angeles or in the greater area, and they haven't been able to do it. And I guess, you know, they have the big stadium issue. Someone's got to spend $1 billion on a new ballpark, you know, a new football stadium, state of the art. And, you know, with the California economy, that's not going to happen with public money. So
right.
It could be years before they get a team.
It's just crazy. My wife is from Orange County, And nobody cares about NFL, really. I mean, you got some people that have kind of gotten on board and they're San Diego Charger fans, but it's not like a real passionate thing. I think people just try and get into college football and then they just, well, it's LA. They're apathetic towards a lot of things.
USC is their professional team.
Yeah. now USC, not as special as it once was. I don't know. It'd be weird to be down there without a pro football team. I mean, now we're going to have a generation of people growing up here without an NBA team, and that's going to be weird to me too. But hey,
yeah, that's a strange situation. The NFL fans in LA though do get it pretty good in terms of watching games on television because they always get the best games every day. They don't have blackout games and forced to watch the local team and all that.
Yeah, I guess that's true. So let's jump into the kind of the latest news here. Carlos Baggio dealt for money that may go to Miss Hernandez, if we will. And what happened to Carlos Baggio this year? And this kind of opens up a further discussion that I'm really interested in getting your take on is a lot of times, I'm sure you've seen it over the years, you get players that come through the system, they're as young as 21, as old as 24, and they just crush it in the minors. And it's the path to get all the way up to the bigs. And then they get to the bigs, and it doesn't work out. And they just can't cut it in the bigs, and then they bounce back down to the minors, and they're never the same. It happened to Jeff Clement. It happened to, Brandon Wood is the perfect example, right? A guy that was just, he finally got up and failed and went down and failed, but he never dominated the levels that he did when he was before his prime. And it seemed like Carlos Baggio, and to some effect, that kind of happened this year too, where he just really lost a lot of his power, and his numbers said he was banging a lot of ground balls. And why do you think that happens?
I think there's multiple layers to that question that that I could touch on. I think first and foremost, they talk about how difficult it is to reach the majors for that first time. And these players, they spend their whole lives trying to reach this goal. And they have, they go through their amateur career, and then they get drafted or signed into an organization, and they have to work their way up the ladder and progress and get better, and it takes years. And then they finally get that major league opportunity. And if they don't immediately have success, they usually get sent back down. And that kind of comes around to sort of a saying that you hear all the time in AAA was that it's extremely difficult to get to the major leagues, and it's even harder to stay there. And it kind of makes you realize how good the big leaguers are compared to the AAA players, the guys who were able to stay there for years. And, I'll use Pagero's name, but this could describe any player who gets his first AAA call up. All right, you had a good year in AAA. That's why you got caught up, okay? You're playing very well in AAA. You get to the major leagues. It's your dream come true. You get a few starts. You get a few at-bats. It's not going well. You're having trouble getting hits, or you're a pitcher and you're getting knocked around, and you get sent back to AAA, and it's like, poof, dream gone. But yeah, it's not gone. You still have a chance to get back, but you realize that what you were doing wasn't working. Even if it was a small sample size, which it is for so many players, as we know, looking at the big picture, but for them, it's like, wow, I got 38 at bats and I had 5 hits. Gee, I must be doing something wrong. I've got to change my game. I've got to do something so that I can stay there at my next chance. And, it's just such a mental grind, and that's such an overused word in baseball, grind, but it's right. So accurate. And it's just mentally crushing if you don't have success right away. So I think guys can really get caught up in that. And then you mentioned for Pagero, he didn't do as well in AAA this year as he did last year. Well, we learned later he had a pretty major deal off the field going on mm-hmm. that was in his head all season long. So, there's a lot of things that can contribute to a guy not playing as well as you think he might.
Yeah, I mean, you make a good point definitely about the off-the-field things. It's something that I think a lot of times we don't really consider. You just kind of look at the numbers and see how their player's performing, and you just think, well, what the heck's going on there? And for Pagero's case, too, I mean, that's what we always loved about Pagero, right, was that he had the one tool that was just so incredible, but everything else about him was kind of broken at the major league level. And you can make it work in AAA, but gosh, I will miss him coming up to the plate because, you know, when I wrote an article on Pagero and when he was designated for the first time about 10 days ago or whenever that was, you know, I was kind of pouring through the numbers and seeing what he did in the majors. And he didn't get fooled by off-speed stuff, which is what so many of the players who are just pure sluggers struggle with when they get to the majors, right? They're dead red hitters. Pagero can't hit fastballs in the majors. He hits James Shields changeups that are in the dirt, and he golfs them out for 450-foot homers. It's hysterical.
Yeah, that's I suspect that if we had privy to team scouting reports on Pagero, it would be 4A hitter who can't, you know, has trouble catching up with major league heat, you know, with 96, 97 plus, and that's probably pretty accurate. But, you know, when a player like him has 1,000 AAA at-bats, he has seen a ton of off-speed pitches because that's what you get in AAA. You have all these, you know, older pitchers who are just, you know, fringe major leaguers trying to get back up there who probably don't throw 96 miles per hour, but they do have good command of their off-speed pitches, and that's why they've been to the majors in the past and are able to try to get there again and pitch in AAA. So you see a lot of that type of pitching that you don't see in the lower levels of the farm system, and a guy like Pagero has just seen a ton of it. So, you know, he probably is better at hitting off-speed pitches. Another guy who played in Tacoma for a long time who had the same type of offensive game was Mike Wilson, who, you know, if you threw a bunch of fastballs to him, you'd probably get him out. But if you made a mistake with an off-speed pitch anywhere in his hitting zone, he could just crush it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. I remember Mike Wilson really wanted him to succeed, finally got his shot in the majors. That was kind of a cool moment for a guy that was, you know, such a lifer, a minor league lifer. Yeah. I think, boy, how old was he when he got his call up? I mean, 27, 28 maybe?
27, I think. That was one of the special moments at Cheney Stadium, you know, that people didn't get to see because it happened after a day game. But, you know, the coaching staff who and the organization people who were there that day when he got called up, it was emotional for them because, you know, this was a guy who'd been in their farm system since he was drafted in 2001. And I think it was 2010 when he got called up, I believe, maybe 11. And, you know, that was like everyone was just so happy that yeah. Wilson was going to the big leagues.
Isn't that a little bit more special in a lot of ways when that happens? Because, I mean, I think about this year with Brandon Bance. You know, that's a guy who, in all honesty, will probably never see the big leagues again and didn't really get his way to the big leagues by having an amazing performance. He got there by chance. He got there because he showed up every day and he worked hard and they needed a body and he was the body they got. And is that just so much special for the guys that don't get heralded, but just come and grind every single day? I think that's cool.
Yeah, for me, there's no question. I agree with you. The surprise call-ups or the players who are a little older and have worked for so long and haven't had that chance are far more fulfilling to me as a fan of the game than when like a Nick Franklin or a Mike Zunino gets called up, because everybody knows those guys are going to the major leagues at some point, you know, and it's still a special moment. Don't get me wrong. When any player goes up for his first time, but as you said, it's kind of it's even a better feel good moment when it's the guy who no one expected to get promoted and actually makes it and has his dream come true.
Sure. Another guy, too, that did that, boy, I guess two seasons ago was Luis Antonio Jimenez.
Yeah, that was a good one. Great.
Yeah. I mean, just a guy that you never think would get up there, but just hits, you know, he was just a beast of a man, but he didn't have particularly plus power, just a hitter. That was kind of cool to see him get that September call up. I like when they do that, you know, especially when, you know, maybe there's a spot on the 40-man roster and you know the guy is going to be a minor league free agent after the year and things like that. Just bring him up. Let him get a couple shots. I think it kind of sends a good message to the rest of the roster in AAA too, that says, you know, hey, if you work hard and you perform well, you're going to get rewarded.
Yeah, the Mariners organization used to do that pretty routinely back when Pat Gillick was the GM, going back a ways now, and even into the Bavesia era, that you know, the best player on the AAA team would usually get called up, even if he wasn't a prospect or a part of the future.
Right.
And they kind of got away from that in recent years, and I think a lot of that's because of the youth movement that they're on and the fact that they've got a lot of prospects protected on the 40-man roster, and they can't do it as easily as they could in the past. So, but that's a rewarding thing. You look back at, like, your Mickey Lopez is a great example from years ago who – well, you know, he just had a great year in Tacoma, and there was a spot for him, and his manager pushed for him, and, you know, he got four at-bats and got one hit, and that's his major league career right there. Now he sells real estate in Miami. So
that's great. That's more than most.
Yeah, that's kind of what's cool about baseball.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really, really cool. So, and now you're kind of going through, and the season's about to come together, and God, there's still so many more moves to come, but have you kind of sat down and tried to make sense of how this Tacoma roster is really going to look? Because there are so many candidates for a 25-man roster. I can't even wrap my head around it.
Yeah, it's a real challenge right now, and I've started to think about it. I do a series on my Rainier's blog where we kind of preview the different positions and who might come to Tacoma, and it's going to be a lot of names this year. When I met you the other day at the Mariners preseason media event, pre-spring training media event, I sat down with Chris Gwynn for a while, and even he was scratching his head saying, "We've got too many guys right now." And he takes it pretty lightly because his philosophy is we have 7 weeks of spring training to sort this out, and you know that's when it's going to happen. But right now, you know, Jack's bringing in a lot of guys on minor league contracts, and you know, to just for looks in spring training, free agents, and you know, some of these guys might make the big league team, and you know, pitchers especially like Scott Baker, who they just signed the other day, and the veteran reliever Ramon Ramirez. But what if, you know, where that gets interesting for Chris Gwynn as he puts together a AAA team is, okay, let's say Ramon Ramirez just gets edged out for the last spot in the Mariners bullpen. And then, you know, Zarenzik says, "Hey, we need to keep this guy in the organization because as soon as there's an injury, he's going to be our guy." Yeah. So then Gwynn's got to make room for him on the AAA roster. And so, you know, then there goes one of your young guys back to AA. So there's, or maybe someone gets released, you know? So it's all that stuff plays out in spring training. And sometimes it can be hard to get a handle on.
Yeah, it's crazy to look at all the candidates right now. I mean, in the outfield in Tacoma, people that could be in the outfield, you have Stefan Romero.
Yeah, he will be. Let's put him out there.
Romero will be there. Nate Tenbrink is a guy that's kind of played all over the field, but did play a decent amount in the outfield last year. So you got to consider him as at least in the mix.
Yeah, sure.
You've got Andy Chavez, who they may try and stash at AAA.
Right.
You've got Abraham Almonte, which he may be on the big league team. He may not be, but certainly something there. You have James Jones, who just was added to the 40-man roster. You've got Xavier Avery, who was picked up in the Mike Morse trade, kind of a similar guy to Andy Chavez to have in the organization. I mean, and then you got guys that really, like, what about Jabari Blash, a guy that just killed AA last year, and he's got to see AAA at some point.
Yeah, another guy, Julio Morvan, who Gwynn mentioned by name to me the other day, saying, "Hey, this guy deserves to go up there, but we got to see if there's room."
Yeah, it's unbelievable. My guess is that I would be surprised if Xavier Avery made it through. And the reason I think that is because Andy Chavez is so similar to a kind of player that he is in the organization, really knows Chavez. And if they're going to stash one of those guys that can kind of play all three positions and not hit a whole lot, but add a little bit of speed and versatility, it's probably going to be Andy. And Xavier Avery's on a 40-man, which is full, and there's got to be another room or another, you know, move made before this is all over, because they're clearly going to add someone else that's coming on a major league contract.
Yeah, and you know, there's going to be pitchers who make the team who aren't currently on the 40-man roster. They're going to have to make room for them. Who knows how the catching is going to work out. I wrote up that position on my blog yesterday, and you know, we're assuming it's John Buck and Mike Zunino, but it's, you know, they could go with John Buck and Humberto Quintero and give Zunino more AAA time.
Yeah.
You know, that's if he doesn't look good in spring training. I think we're all hoping that doesn't happen, but you know, it is a possibility. It is something that could happen. So
there's guys, relievers too. Carson Smith, for example, a guy that could definitely be added to the 40-man roster. And you got to make room for, I mean, the thing that people aren't thinking about, too, is that I believe you're going to have to, well, Danny Holton is on the 60-day deal right now, so he's not on the 40-man roster, but he has to be, I believe, during the offseason. So maybe a spot is opened up for him when the season starts, because they'll remove him from the 40-man roster when they put him on the 60 DL during the
season. That's a good little tidbit there.
Yeah.
That's a spot that will make itself available in March.
And then we'll see if they do the same for Stephen Pryor, too, actually, because that was kind of the surprising thing to me that we heard at the luncheon, was that Stephen Pryor, you know, gosh, he could be out through the end of May or longer. It just seems like, gosh, this injury has just been absolutely devastating for him.
Yeah, I was surprised by that news, too. I thought he was good to go for spring training, but it turns out no. So that's another spot that they could put him on the 60-day DL, sure.
Yeah, potentially two spots opening up. So maybe Xavier Avery can breathe a little easier for now, and some of the other fringe guys like Hector Nwesi, who might be in your AAA rotation next year. Sorry about that.
I'm going big league bullpen for Hector. Let's go.
Yeah, you think so?
Seriously, I don't think he can come to Tacoma because he's out of options. So he's got a live arm. Someone will probably take a look at him, think they can fix him and get him back on track. So
sure. He's kind of like a little bit of Miguel Batista, right? A guy that has a live arm and he's got the pitches that move all over the place, but they just kind of tend to move towards the middle of the plate.
Yeah, actually, the general feeling at Cheney Stadium with myself and the folks who work in the press box is we're pro Hector Nwesi, and the reason is Hector works quickly and throws strikes. It might not always have a good result, but he's not dilly-dallying on the mound, and he's not walking a bunch of guys.
Right, and that's where he's...
When you're in the minors, do you appreciate that?
When you're on a road trip... And you're in the middle of nowhere sometimes, right? That's maybe maybe ready to just pack it up and move out. Well, another guy that is going to be interesting to watch this year, too, is Ty Kelly. And I've kind of been talking about Ty a lot on the site. We had him on the podcast last week or the week before. And I really love talking to him because what an interesting guy. And his approach at the plate is just... really, really, really interesting. And, you know, you go through his numbers and, you know, I told him that he swung at less pitches than Joey Votto did last year when he was at AAA. And I think he was surprised by it. But he really mentioned that, you know, he understands and he knows the strike zone really well. And he just feels like if pitchers aren't going to give him anything over the zone, then he's just not going to swing at it. He said he comes up to the plate taking a pitch. That's his thing. He intentionally just says, I'm going to take a pitch because I know the zone and I can get ahead later if I need to. Really interesting. If you liked kind of watching him at the plate, and I know you're kind of you're an advanced baseball thought mind, so you appreciate the plate patience.
Yeah, he was kind of a breath of fresh air when he came in via trade in the middle of last season, or, you know, it was shortly before the deadline. I guess he only played in about 50 games. But, you know, he has a sense of discipline at the plate that is not very common in Mariners minor leaguers. There's always a few guys, and it seems like they're either born with it or they come in from another organization and they have good plate discipline. But the players that come up through the Mariners system often don't improve in that area. So, you know, whenever you look at the Tacoma stats, you always see a lot of rough strikeout to walk ratio. So
yeah.
Anyway, I kind of got sidetracked there, but Kelly,
that's okay. I'm going to segue that into the next player. So go ahead and
Well, Kelly was very different in that, you know, he did see a lot of pitches and he had a long at bats. He's one of those hitters where we all could have saved a lot of time if he just went to the plate and started with a full count. Because it seemed like he got one in every plate appearance.
Right, he's the anti Hector Nwesi, right? He's dragging things out.
Exactly. So, you know, he made a lot of hard contact too, though. It's not. I mean, you know, in your interview, I listened to your podcast with him, and you did a great job with that, and you did say a lot of interesting things. But, you know, he hits the ball pretty hard from both sides of the plate, too. And while that doesn't avail itself with a lot of extra base hits, he had a lot of ringing singles and, you know, line shots into the outfield. So he swings it pretty well from both sides. And then you mix in all those walks. And, you know, the one thing that you never know, and you won't ever know until the player gets a chance, is will that strikeout to walk ratio hold up at all in the major leagues? Because pitchers have better command, of course, and you know, if they realize, hey, this rookie for the Mariners named Kelly, he's taking a pitch every time, then they're just going to throw him strike one every time. And that's you know, so you have to be able to adjust to that in the majors, and some guys are able to do it, and you know, others can't. Nick Swisher, when he was in AAA, we saw a lot of him because he was with Sacramento and we play them all the time. And he was had a, you know, well, he's a different player because he had a lot of power, but he was another guy who, you know, just start the at bat with a full count because he's always going to get to a full count in every plate appearance, it seemed like. And then he was able to take all those walks to the major leagues with him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was an interesting one to watch to come through the ranks there, and he was certainly fun to watch once he came up too. That was right along the lines of when I started opening my eyes to walks and, you know, the importance of raising pitcher counts and things like that. The segue that I was getting to when we were talking about a lot of free swingers who maybe don't take a lot of walks is a guy that was really they talked about him a lot at the luncheon was Stefan Romero, and he was there, and it seemed like the defense was the big kind of thing that everyone's talking about. Well, how's his defense? And I was pretty interested to see kind of how dodgy all of the talk of his defense was. Well, he's a hitter. That's what it kept coming to. Well, he's a hitter. And sometimes it's good and sometimes it's not so good, which makes me think that it's not so good. Now, I haven't seen Romero play the outfield in person, but I'm just kind of curious as to not necessarily if you think he's a good, you know, defensive player or not, but whether you have seen some things that would indicate that help is on the way, or if he's going to have to just hit his way onto the big league roster.
Regarding his defense, last year, I believe, was his, well, as a pro, it was his first time playing the outfield on a regular basis. And at the beginning of the year when he started it, he joined the team late because he had an injury in spring training. So when he first came in and started playing out there, it was like, uh-oh, this doesn't look very good. Then as the season progressed, he got a lot better because, you know, you have to give him leeway. This is the minor leagues. It's for training people.
Right.
And, you know, he got a lot better as the season went on. And he started to make some nice running catches down the line and in the gap. And he started to get better first steps. And, you know, and then so you started to see, all right, this could work out. He only played 75 games in the outfield last year because various injuries. So I think that that's not a lost cause. I think he can become acceptable out there for sure. The bat, though, you say hit his way to the big leagues. I think that's what it all comes down to. And
yeah, you know, and he hasn't done enough yet.
Not at the AAA level. This is a guy who in the type of player we're talking about here, I think he needs to destroy the PCL. And that could happen. And the one thing that doesn't show on any stat page, but you can see with your eyes when you watch him play and bat 400 times, is that he had better at bats against the pitchers with big league stuff in the PCL than the guys flipping a bunch of garbage up there.
Right.
He could hit the pitchers with the good stuff, with the major league fastball, the bullpen prospects and the starting pitching prospects around the league. He had good at bats against those guys better than some of his teammates. And that's where even a person like me, who's just a radio broadcaster, but saw it every day, could say, okay, that's why he's a prospect, is because he can hang in there better against the pitchers with good stuff than some of the other guys.
Interesting. Yeah. I think this is kind of a prove it year for him. And it's going to be interesting to see what he does, because if he doesn't necessarily do what you say and start to really rip it down there and take a big step forward, then, you know, I think he's in danger a little bit of becoming an afterthought. And that would be unfortunate. We certainly don't want to see him go the route of Vinny Catricala, who I'm still just so depressed about. I mean, I can't.
Yeah.
I'm just so depressed about Vinny, because that was my guy. I mean, that's the one, almost like, you know, Stefan Romero was a lot of people's kind of, every organization has a player that can hit in the minors that doesn't really play defense or do anything like that, but he can hit. And everyone says, well, what about this guy? You know, that was Kachikawa. That's Romero. Did you kind of talk to Vinny at all when he was kind of going through his crushing slumps? I mean, I know he ended up back in Jackson, but that came after he just could not cut it in AAA. Did you ever talk to him about what happened or anything?
We had a couple good interviews during that season. I mean, Vinny is I tip my hat to him, because, you know, he was having a rough season, and he would still, you know, come on the air with me once or twice, three times during the season when I asked him, and would talk about how tough it's been, you know, and he was open about it, and he didn't shy away from it. But you could kind of just see it. I wasn't tight with him or anything like that. You could just see him just having a rough, you know, he was having a rough time. It was his first time as a pro that he wasn't hitting 300, that he wasn't, you know, contributing on offense on a regular basis. And, you know, obviously we all kept rooting for him, and, you know, there'd be a game where he'd get a couple of hits and you're like, all right, maybe this will lead to something. Maybe he'll get hot. And you're thinking that, and then, you know, it didn't develop into some hot streak. And, you know, and in the end, you just kind of felt bad for him. And then he got sent to AA and in 2013 and, you know, designated in Oakland. Oakland's always willing to claim guys off waivers, so they took a look at him, and, you know, they let him go. And, you know, now we find out that his head's probably been in a new career for a while, because the report came out the other day that he was already a month into police academy training in Sacramento. So it sounds like he had, you know, no intention of playing this year, that he wanted to move on with life. And, you know, that's more power to him. That's great. And, I hope it all works out for him.
Personality wise, who are some of your favorite guys that have kind of come through AAA that have, you know, maybe ended up with the Mariners, maybe ended up in another big league organization, but guys that you really enjoyed working with, interviewing, interacting with on a regular basis?
Let's see. You want to go back some years? Or do you
You set the scale.
Back in the early days of my time with the Rainiers. So this, I've been here 15 years now. In the early days, two of my favorites from the early 2000s were Scott Podsednik and especially a second baseman we had named Jermaine Clark, who got a couple cups of coffee in the big league. But that guy should have been a professional comedian. And he's now a scout. And I'm like, come on, Jermaine, don't be a scout. Go stand up. Anyway, he was hilarious and fun to have on the team. And Podsednik was also great. And he and Clark were buddies. And they were just a fun duo to be around, you know, at all times during the season and a half or 2 years that those guys were here together. And more recently, I'm a big fan of Brian Sweeney, who's been with the Rainiers for more different seasons than anybody in the history of Tacoma baseball, actually.
Wow.
And, you know, he's my age, so that he's just a great guy to have around in terms of being a veteran leader and a lead by example guy, and then also someone who I could talk a lot of baseball and non-baseball with, and I really enjoyed having him on the team this past year and in the couple of years beforehand. Josh Kinney was on our club last year. He's a great guy and always fun to talk to. There's tons of them, though. I mean, you just go through these, you always feel like you leave someone out, but there's a lot of quality individuals who've come through the organization who are fun to chit chat with over the years.
On the flip side, I'm not going to ask you who are the terrible people.
Okay.
I'm going to ask who are the players that you kind of felt most sad that things didn't work out like they should have for them? Guys that, you know, I mean, you just talked about, you know, to players that maybe things didn't work out like they should have. Are there any guys that they were either traded away or they passed through and never made it big and worked hard that you kind of lament their lack of success in their career?
I think there's a lot of them. You know, everyone who's with the team for a while and you get to know them a little bit and you find out you like this person and then they don't get that chance in the majors that you were hoping they would get. Yeah, there's a ton of players that applies to. The one thing that's great about being in AAA as opposed to the lower levels of the minors along that line is that the majority of players in AAA have either been in the majors or are going to be in the majors at some point, at least for a day, right, or for a few weeks or something, you know? So they've all at least had a shot and can say, hey, I was a major leaguer at one point. I think a lot of those types of players, though, in the question that you asked, I have to go back to the best team that Tacoma's had in my time here, the 2001 Rainiers PCL Championship Club, best record of any team that I've ever seen here. And
2001, pretty good year for the Mariners organization.
Mariners won 116 games. There were not many call-ups. The Mariners had hardly any injuries. There was very little roster movement during the season, and thus the AAA team stayed together and won a ton of games. And there were some very good AAA players on that team who never got a day in the big leagues. Mm-hmm. First baseman named Todd Betts, who was one of the keys to this championship team, and you know, didn't get called up to the majors. An outfielder named Chad Alexander, another guy. Two catchers we had all year, both super guys, Blake Barthol and Jim Horner, who's now the AA manager for the Mariners, neither got a day in the big leagues. And, you know, it's there are more on that team. And, like, it's kind of amazing to me that team, the best I've seen here, they might have 10 key players who didn't get a day in the majors, which is just kind of amazing.
Well, how about Denny Stark? I'm just looking at the roster right now.
Yeah, well, he was PCL Pitcher of the Year, and, you know, he did get called up, and he ended up having arm injuries that waylaid his career. But, you know, that was the best single season of any starting pitcher I've ever seen in AAA. So he was a guy who would normally have been called up in May, but the Mariners that year, they didn't need a sixth starter. Or when they did, they went with Joel Pinheiro, who was swinging in the bullpen in the rotation. So, that was the sixth starter. So Stark was left to sit here and go 14-2 in the PCL, which is, you just never see that.
Yeah. Man, Brian Fuentes on that team.
Yeah.
Yeah, he got called up that year. He was part of the team that year. Yeah, Brett Tomko that year. Brett Tomko making a comeback, apparently.
Yeah, I read that somewhere online. He doesn't want to give it up, does he? I think he's over 40 now. So
yeah, well, if he's still throwing in the 90s, which apparently he is, but you never know with that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
that would be very weird to see him get back into the majors. But then again, Mark Mulder is pitching in spring training this year, so stranger things could happen.
Yeah, exactly. Wouldn't be surprised if Mulder makes a team as the lefty situational guy.
God, that would be weird. I mean, he hasn't been in the majors for 5 years, 6 years maybe, and he was bad then. I mean, he hasn't been good in the majors since, I think, 2006 or something like that. That's a long time.
Never count out a left-handed pitcher.
That's true. If you're a left-handed reliever that can throw some breaking pitches that'll knock lefties out, you'll always have a chance at a job, right? That you otherwise would not.
Yeah, it's amazing too. They have knowledge of that too. Bobby Laframboise has been on our team last year and the season before. At one point, we were talking about something, and I can't remember how the conversation went to cause this to say, and he just kind of flippantly shrugs and goes, I'm left-handed. I'll be around forever.
Oh, I love that. It's true. It's true. And boy, and if he keeps putting those numbers together like he did in Tacoma last year, he's going to get a crack. I mean, he's going to get another crack. He's on the 40-man now, which helps things, too. I mean, God, do you like or dislike the 40-man roster?
It adds an element of confusion to things that they have this whole, you know, extended roster to choose guys from, but it protects the players.
Right.
This way, you know, if you're the AAA backup shortstop to Derek Jeter, or let's go back, Cal Ripken. Okay, let's say you're AAA behind Cal Ripken Jr. This way, it gives players an opportunity to get claimed by another organization rather than just get trapped there with no future. You know,
sure.
you know, like Salt Lake, the Angels AAA club. They've had one of the best first basemen in the PCL the last couple of years. Efren Navarro, you've never heard of him because he's stuck behind Albert Pujols and he just gets called up in September. So, you know, this guy is going to run out of options, I think, after this year. And, you know, the 40-man roster rules then provide a way for him to get out of the Angels organization and get out from under the shadow of Pujols and, you know, maybe try to make the big leagues with someone else.
Sure. I feel like I agree with you on a lot of those things. I think I wish that it was like 45 men instead of 40, because you hate seeing organizations lose quality players that might become something. They're not something yet, and they're taking a while to get there, but they still might be something. And then someone like Jeremy Bonderman gets called up, who you know is going to be around for four or five starts, and the player is lost forever. I mean, you lose that guy from your organization forever because sometimes you just need a body at the major league level. And that's always really tough to see. I think that's kind of a flaw in the system, but nature of the beast a little bit.
Yeah, I suppose so. You know, I understand what you're saying on that. But again, I think it comes down to, you know, they're trying to give opportunities for players. The rules exist because they've been negotiated by the players' union so that a guy can try to remain in the major leagues.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's shift gears a little bit. I would love to talk a little bit about kind of the art of broadcasting for you as someone that's, you know, in your 15th year. Tell me a little bit about kind of the prep that you do before games like that. And one thing I'm interested in is now there are so many more freely available statistics for minor leaguers than they used to be. I mean, you can go to Minor League Central. You can go to there's another site that I saw today that now has heat maps and spray charts for minor leaguers, which is not something that's ever been available to the public. How much of that stuff do you look at and feel like you want to talk about in the broadcast? Do you try and keep things pretty simple, or do you kind of have a backlog of advanced stuff that maybe you talk about if there's an exceptionally long at bat or a pitcher's getting shelled or something like that?
My style, and you know, other guys might have a different style, but for me, I don't get into the advanced advanced metrics on the air, or at least very, very rarely. I just don't think that the listening audience really wants all that. I think that the small percentage of fans who do want that are able to go online and find it for themselves, mm-hmm. and that I don't need to be talking about it on the air. So I don't, things like, you know, looking at, you know, I do look at those sites. Like, I'll go to FanGraphs just to get, like, a pitcher's repertoire before I see him for the opposing team, you know, just to find out what he throws. And they're in our locker room, our manager usually puts up just whatever he dug up from his computer resources, you know, the opposing pitchers' repertoire as well, and, you know, velocities and stuff, because they have their own database through the Mariners with, you know, last time scouts saw a guy or whatever.
Right.
So that's important to me, is finding out about the opposing pitcher and what he's going to throw. But in terms of, like, you know, real in-depth stuff, it's out there. If people want it, they can find it online. And I think that's a small percentage of the fan base. So, like, when there's a long at bat or a delay, I'm more interested in using, background stories about players to fill that time, or news from around baseball to fill that time, than to try to get into in-depth statistical stuff.
Sure. I don't know if you've seen this. I just found it today. I didn't even know it existed. MLBFarm.com, it's the site I was talking about before. Spray charts and hitter heat maps. I mean, this is really, really cool stuff. And it seems like stuff that's totally relevant to talk about in a broadcast, too. Hey, this guy hits the ball to all fields, as you can say. His power is mostly left, but he has a tendency to kind of roll over and hit a lot of grounders to second and stuff like that. The amount of information that is just freely available is... it's actually kind of mind-boggling. And I think, for me, it really opens this window to understanding the minors that we just didn't have before, you know, and you kind of have to rely on maybe a scout saw someone 3 years ago and then no one else has really seen the guy. So the scouting report just kind of tumbles down and down and down and down. And
that's a thing that happens in baseball.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's kind of cool to like see things for yourself. And I'm sure eventually we'll start getting defensive metrics in the minors and things like that too.
Yeah, I'm going to check out that site. I didn't know that that existed. I'd be curious to see how much information they have that they're basing it on, and you know, what kind of accuracy they have. There is a group, Baseball Information Solutions, I think they're called BIS.
BIS.
Wrong, but they're at every AAA game. Okay. And that's a subscription site, I believe. I think you have to pay to get their information. I'm not 100% sure on that, but like they're, you know, I just know that they're at every AAA game, so I would take their information or what you could get from them, you know, with a little more faith in the data.
Right. Yeah. I would check out the site and take a look at it because it's pretty cool. Oh. Yeah. Baseball Information Systems. That's where I believe UZR, when they calculate UZR, they get data from BIS. They're the provider for that data. So, very cool. If it's cool, I kind of want to talk to you about, you know, when I talked to James Paxton and when I talked to Brandon Bantz, you know, I'm really interested in, and I know we talked about this a little bit earlier with guys like Mike Wilson. You talk about the moment, right, where these guys, you know, they know that they're getting the call, that they're going to the big leagues. Well, you yourself had a moment like that when you got to go and kind of fill in some games with Rick in the booth, kind of in the transition period. What was that like for you? I mean, because obviously that's that's a dream of sorts, I would assume, for you as well. When did you find out that that was going to happen? And what was the whole process kind of going through all that like?
Yeah, that was a career highlight. I had done a few major league games before, but they kind of had an asterisk on them. So when the Montreal Expos were, when they were a lame duck franchise, and they had a couple of interleague series in Seattle, and they would pick up local broadcasts. They sent one guy on the road because, well, they were being cheapskates, okay? So they sent one guy on the road and had local guys fill in, and this was a major league broadcast. It was not paid. Hey, we're just going to, we'll give you some experience. The lead guy, who was great, just said, hey, I'm just looking for some help. Someone who can do a few innings and, just take a little bit of the pressure off him. And so I helped him out twice, a series at Safeco in 03 and another one in 04. So I'd done six major league games and I'd called some innings of play by play. And I had a highlight reel from that. But when the Mariners contacted me in 2011, when Randy Adamack emailed saying, hey, Mike, we're looking at bringing you in for a few games this year. What do you think? Stay in touch. And that just came from an email. But I was like, wow, that's fantastic. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't reply to this fast enough. And then when he finally did, it wasn't until the season started when he got to me with some dates. We were in Las Vegas and he sent me an email. We were playing a day game. So it must have been a Sunday because those are the only ones they play there. So I got an email from him saying, hey, we're looking at some dates. Can you do, you know, these two or whatever? And I got back to him right away and said, yeah, or I called him after I was off the air. And, it was a dream come true to get a chance to do it. And then Rick Riz is the ultimate professional and he makes mm-hmm. you feel comfortable. Ditto for Kevin Kremen. And, you know, you feel like you're a part of the broadcast team. And they invited me back a couple of times. I think I did a total of five games for them. And, you know, it was just a ton of fun. And I'm probably never going to get a major league full-time broadcasting job, but at least I'll be able to say, hey, I had a chance to do a few games and experience it. And, you know, it's something I'll never forget.
Sure. Yeah. Did you have any iconic moments, would you say, in your tenure, in your spot games, things that you really remember that was really cool to call or things like that?
Felix Hernandez pitched a couple of the games that I broadcast, and you know, that was great. I was there not the day, but the day after the second game, where Ichiro was a Yankee, right?
Yeah.
When he switched dugouts, basically, for the first game of the series, and I can't remember who did that game with Rick Riz. It was when they were going through the kind of the carousel of broadcasters.
Yep.
And I had the second game with Ichiro with the Yankees, and, you know, that was just kind of it was just unbelievable. It was like you couldn't even believe that this was happening, you know. And then another thing that happened was that, you know, I was broadcasting, I was doing play-by-play for three innings per game. And the first year, I think I did three games, so nine innings, didn't call a Mariner run.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the second year, I did a couple of games, and I finally got a Mariners run in, I think, my fifth and final game. So I was not good luck for the home team.
Right. After the season ended, and the Mariners kind of went through the search for the next broadcaster, ultimately going with Aaron Goldsmith. How involved were you in the process of being considered for the next kind of Mariners guy?
I was in it right up until the very end, and didn't go through the process of having an interview or an audition or any of that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that anyone ever thought that that would even be necessary, having already been a fill-in person there and knowing all the players. So I figured I was either going to get a phone call saying I got the job, or I was going to find out I didn't get it. And the latter happened instead. And here we are today.
There you are. And now it's Goldsmith, my age, within 2 or 3 days, my age.
Uh-huh.
Weird. What am I doing with my life? That's
hey, you and me both.
That's what I want to know. But love Aaron, and he's done a good job. So it's all good. Tell me, let's get back to one more thing here. I want to hear about life on the road. What you're sick of restaurants wise? What you'll never eat at again? If you got any kind of funny stories from traveling around or anything like that to share.
Yeah, the travel's always the subject in AAA, really in the minors, but it's different in AAA because at the lower levels, the travel is long bus rides. That's what it is. And there's that whole kind of American romantic story of the minor league guys in A-ball taking the long bus ride through middle America and seeing the world and trying to live that dream of getting to the major leagues. And
right.
In AAA, that's not happening. That's not the way it works here. We fly commercial airlines everywhere we go. Our league's gigantic. So they're a bus trip is very rare. There are a couple of them, and you actually look forward to them when you get them. Cause you know, it's an easier travel than the flying, because our bus trips are like usually when cities are just 2 or 3 hours apart, like Nashville and Memphis. And then you have to get lucky and get them on the same road trip. But because they don't always schedule around that, like Albuquerque and El Paso are two teams that they reformatted the divisions this year. And so now we're going to be playing Albuquerque and El Paso 16 times each a year and take two road trips to each. It's a 4-hour bus ride between the two. So do we go down there and play them both on the same road trip back to back? No, we don't. Not one time this year. So we've got all these flights in and out of there that are going to be kind of our roughest travel days probably. But anyway, I digress. So the travel is commercial airline, and we're fortunate compared to some other teams in the league. We might have longer travel in terms of miles, but because we fly out of Seattle, we have a lot of direct flights, which other cities in the league can't claim. So that kind of plays in our favor up here. But that's the grind, though, because the league office is rightfully paranoid about missing games, having games canceled because either a team doesn't make it or a team's gear doesn't make it, which is happens. There's even a word for it in AAA. It's called "we got bagged out." Our bags didn't make it. You know, we're talking about the baseball bags, the bats, the uniforms, all the gear, the trainer's gear that they travel with.
Right.
It seems like every 3 or 4 years there'll be a PCL game that gets bagged out. So anyway, so the league encourages you to take the earliest flight of the day, the first flight of the day. They want you to move on. They want you in the city. You know, no, trying to cut it close and, you know, get more sleep so you can get in there on the last flight in. The league frowns on that. So there's a lot of early mornings, just a lot of zonked out teams, zonked out baseball players sitting around airports at 5 a.m. waiting for that 6 a.m. flight. Get to the airport, the team bus gets to the airport usually 2 hours before the flight because we have all that gear we have to check in, and plus we've got 30 people traveling and there's security, and you can't miss the flight. You just cannot when you have a group this size. So you spend a lot of time sitting around in airports, and some of the funny stuff that happens on the road occurs, you know, in airports. I'll never forget seeing Pat Borders, Rainier's catcher and former World Series MVP, at some layover, I guess, probably in Denver or Dallas, sleeping under a row of chairs with a couple of older women sitting in the chairs above him, just chit-chatting about, you know, whatever. And, you know, they've got a former World Series MVP sleeping under their airport chairs. It's like, you know, and that happens, though, because you get so tired. You play a night game and you get back to the hotel at 12, and most guys can't go to sleep right away because we're conditioned for the night, because that's right. What games are, and you have some energy after the game. And so you go to the earliest you can fall asleep, like 1 or 2, and then you're up at 4 in the morning to go to the airport. So there's a lot of the PCL travel is trying to figure out when you can sleep and trying to maximize that time.
Definitely.
Yeah.
What do you do to kill time when you're on the flights, when you're sitting at the airport? Are you watching movies? You reading books? And what do the players generally do?
I personally will sit in an airport. Sometimes I'll work on that Rainier's blog that I do. Sometimes I'll read books. That really covers it right there. I'm a big reader. I read a lot of books, so I can always fill time doing that. And then if you're in an airport with wireless, you can, you know, get online and maybe read some stories, get some of your preparation work done. Players do a lot of movie watching, on their computers or whatever they bring with them on the road. That's a big thing these days, that, you know, now that you can do that on the road, which wasn't the case years ago.
Right.
Let's see. There's a lot of guys just try to find those spots to sleep. And yeah, the one thing that's definitely crucial for a PCL baseball player is having the ability to sleep on airplanes, and the majority of them can do it. So a lot of times if you're ever on a plane and you like walk back towards the bathroom and you see like 25 young athletic men wearing sport coats all sleeping in their chairs, you are in the presence of a AAA baseball team.
I couldn't do it. I'd be wrecked. I cannot sleep on planes or buses or anything. I can't do it at all.
Yeah, buses are tough for me, but I can usually do it on a plane.
I just can't sleep sitting up. I mean, we did some international flights last year when my wife and I traveled a little bit, and you try your best to sleep, but I'm just constantly in that state of half asleep and half awake and frustrated that I can't go either way. Mm-hmm. And just feeling slightly nauseous because of the movement the whole time. It's a mess. I don't know how you guys do it.
Yeah, it takes some getting used to, but you know, the travel is part of the fun part of the job for me. I mean, not the process of traveling, but the getting to go to all these different cities, pardon me, and, you know, going to them enough times where you start to kind of learn your way around. And, you know, that's part of the fun.
Very much so. At this point, you probably got you're in Nashville. You know the spot in Nashville that you like to go eat at. And do you guys kind of stay like at the same hotel every time in the same area?
It depends. In our league, the home team works out their own deal with a team hotel that the visiting team stays in. So we don't get to pick where we stay. And thank goodness there's been a real trend in terms of improving the quality of the hotels around the league. So now we don't have teams really trying to save money on this and putting you in substandard hotels. So
right.
we stay in not big league hotels, but you know, quality hotels everywhere we go now. So that's been really a nice change that I've seen in the last 10 years.
I always think about the Seinfeld episode. Costanza is talking to Bernie Williams, and Bernie Williams goes, "Are you the guy that put us in that Ramada in Milwaukee?"
Yeah. I've seen, I'm not going to name names, but I saw a longtime former major leaguer who was in AAA trying to get back up there just basically freak out on a hotel employee at some awful hotel we were in Omaha 15 years ago that was just a legendary freak out. And you know, people loved it. The people who saw it loved it and still talking about it today. And you know, fortunately we don't really have that situation anymore. We do have some though that just haven't changed. And this might be my problem and our trainer's problem more than anything else. And that's not even really a problem, I guess. But Sacramento joined the PCL in 2000. That's when they built their great ballpark. Mm-hmm. And so that's, 14 seasons. And I've been going there 8 games a year, 14 seasons. Plus, we've played them in the playoffs multiple times. And they've never changed their hotel. So I've spent over 100 days of my life in this same hotel. And it's a nice hotel. There's no problem with this hotel. It's just, you kind of wish that I kind of wish they would change it just to change it.
Yeah.
I've spent too much time there. It's got to change.
What's the chain? I mean, what's a standard chain of hotel that you're staying at? You're not staying at like at a Hyatt Regency. It's a Marriott. Are we at a Courtyard? Are we at a Quinta?
We've got a lot of Courtyards, this Hilton Garden Inn, which is kind of a low-end chain, but it's still nice.
I live very close to a Hilton Garden Inn in Boston.
Okay, they're all the same.
Yep.
we stay in like the nicer quality Holiday Inns. Holiday Inns can really vary, but there's a few in the league that are like good Holiday Inns. We have a nice Sheraton in Salt Lake City that's just terrific, you know, so... here in Tacoma, they stay at the Hotel Murano downtown, which is considered to be one of the nicest hotels along the West Coast. And they've been great to work with. And, they give us a reasonable rate so we can do this. And so teams love coming in here. So, it varies quite a bit, but not as much as it used to. And that's a good thing. We used to have some real duds and they've been weeded out.
Yeah, maybe next time they come into Tacoma, we'll be like, hey, you know the hotel we're putting you at, Bet. It's maybe a step above this 14-year-old Sacramento hotel.
I like the Sacramento hotel.
You like the Sacramento hotel, okay.
I just spent too many nights there. I don't want to make that clear. It's fine. It's just too much of my life has passed in that hotel.
Any upgrades over the years? Are we talking getting new TVs, or are we still, we've got the same TVs, same, you're probably sleeping in the same comforter that's been there for 10 years?
Well, they had a remodel 3 or 4 years ago. We appreciate it.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go. All right, man. Well, good stuff. I'm going to let you go. I appreciate you coming on. And, you know, I know we got a Cal UW basketball game coming up here in right after Valentine's Day on February 15th. So I hope my dogs can avenge their previous crushing in Cal. They're both right next to each other in the Pac-12.
Yeah, I'll be at that game. I can't figure out my Cal Bears. They won their first 5 Pac-12 games, most of them on the road, and I thought, wow, this is going to be a great team. And then they just started sleepwalking, and they've lost 3 in a row. So I don't know. Who knows what's going
to
happen?
Yeah, I have no idea what's going on with the dogs either. And to be honest, I am not paying attention as much as I used to, I'll tell you that.
It's my favorite fan sport. I love it. I love the Pac-12 hoops.
I do. I love college basketball too. I did not miss a single game when I was in the dog pack when I was at UW from 02 to 06. I was at UW.
Wow.
And didn't miss a single game. I missed about 5 my freshman year, and I think I went to every game the years after. Those were fun. That was the number one seed team with Nate Robb and Brandon Roy, and that was really fun.
Yeah, great teams. That's how I got into it. Someone in the freshman dorms at Cal said, hey, let's go to the basketball game. And once I went once, I was hooked. And by the time I got out of there, they had Jason Kidd and Lamon Murray, and I was hooked for life.
Yeah. Sharif Abdul-Rahim.
Yeah, there you go.
We're going to be pulling him out. Okay, good stuff, man. Go Dogs. You know how it is. And look forward to hearing you this year. And I'm ready for the season to start. Are you ready? I've had enough.
I'll be ready. I'm not quite there yet, but I've started working on it. So, yeah, I'll be ready. And it's going to be a lot of fun. This is going to be a fun season for Rainiers baseball. They all are, but a lot of changes this year with a new coaching staff, a new manager, and it sounds like we're going to have a lot of new faces on the roster. So that always makes things interesting. And, you know, it seems like the Mariners are on the upswing too. So, you know, hopefully everything will be moving the right direction this year.
Yeah, boy, there's still a lot of moves that that might be made left in this offseason. So a lot of things to come. I believe opening day for you guys, April 3rd, is that right?
April 3rd, we open at home, okay. Which is a rarity. We usually open on the road. So
we always open in Oakland. So
yeah.
I believe this is I think it's the fourth year in a row the Mariners have opened in Oakland.
Wow.
Yeah, and I don't understand how that. Well, they did open in Japan a few years back, but then of course they came back and then they opened in Oakland again. So they did double road games at Oakland. So not only do they always start in Oakland, but they're doing international and then back to Oakland. So I don't know. There was a really interesting article. I think it was on Grantland or something last month about the people that make the Major League Baseball schedule. And it was kind of interesting. I'm sure it's not an easy job, especially now that you got interleague all year long. I mean, it's just crazy. We saw some weird stuff last year.
Yeah, the baseball schedule, even in the PCL, everyone complains about it, but they think they can do it. It's one of those things everyone in the league thinks they can do it better, but actually if they knew all the stipulations and all the intricacies that went into it, they'd realize that it's a real pain in the butt.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, Mike, well, good luck to you and the Rainiers, and I'm sure I'll see you again coming up here sometime soon.
All right, thanks a lot, Scott. It's great to be on your show.
Thank you. Thanks for coming on.